everyone. Thanks for joining us for another episode of LID Radio Podcast. I am Francesca and I'll be your host for today. For this episode, we have a very special guest with us, Tom Cheesewright. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you.
So Tom Cheesewright is an applied futurist, helping people and organisations around the world to see the future more clearly, share their vision and respond with innovation. An accomplished speaker and broadcaster, he specialises in connecting tomorrow's world to today's experience, making sense of what's happening next and why. Tom's clients include Global 500 corporations, government departments, industry bodies and charities. In Tom's book, High Frequency Change, he explains why we feel like change is happening faster than ever before. We're told we must adapt or we get left behind, like so many big brands that have failed in recent years. But does change really happen faster now? Or is something else going on? The book offers a new and more nuanced explanation of this accelerated age, and he shares a prescription for both people and organisations. What must we do to ensure sustainable success and be truly future ready? High frequency change informs and advises based on data and original anecdotes from history, popular culture, and Tom's work with a huge range of organisations around the world. So Tom, let's talk about the book. How did the concept of how change is changing come about? Where did your inspiration come from, and how do you see it informing businesses today?
So I guess this is the compound experience of now 7 years as a full-time applied futurist, working with very diverse organisations from charities to banks to bits of government, manufacturers and retailers. And it comes from seeing the same trends over and over again.
Yeah.
I think we've all been battered with the message that change happens faster now. You hear it from famous futurists like Ray Kurzweil from Google.
Yeah.
You hear it from lots of business magazines now. And I think people share this sense as well. There's a general sense amongst the adult population that things happen faster than they used to. In fact, I surveyed 2,000 adults in the UK and 70% came back and said, yes, we feel like change happens faster now.
Yeah.
I bought into the argument at first that everything's accelerating. We're all on this same journey and someone's put their foot down in the car we all ride along the grand arc of history. And that seemed to make a lot of sense to me until a historian friend told me it was absolute nonsense.
Okay.
And that people had that feeling at various points in the past. And so I sort of set out on this mission to try and explain the gap, if you like, between how we feel and what's really happening.
Brilliant. I mean, we all know with change, especially in technology, it seems that there comes these good and bad side effects. Do you believe that unless we're embracing these changes and act as future-ready organisations, we will get left behind?
Yeah, I absolutely do. In the book, I lay out this idea of high-frequency change, and it's very much driven by technology. If you think about the sort of interconnectedness of the world now, how fast products, ideas, cultural memes flow around the world, it really forces you to think differently about how you operate as an organisation. You can no longer plan out your future in 5, 10 or even 20-year time spans.
Sure.
With a long-term mission and objective and just striving towards that, just doing the same thing you do today, tomorrow, but slightly better.
Yeah.
Instead, you really have to think about the way you operate and think about what it takes to respond to these fast-flowing ideas and products and services that move around the world, and do so in a way that radically changes the organisation to help it to keep up. And that affects everything we do. It affects our day-to-day work as leaders and managers. It affects the structure of the organisation. It affects finance. It affects our normal planning activities like budgeting and your strategy setting. It touches every bit of the business, including actually skills and who and how we recruit.
So, I mean, you said that planning ahead is kind of more difficult, sort of 5, 10, 20-year plans. But is there a way that we can plan for the future without sort of, with it being more flexible and being able to change and being more, I guess, able to change with the times? Because I think not planning is quite daunting. But sort of how do you get around that with your clients?
I think it's really important to understand why you plan at different time frames, why you look at sort of the near horizon and the far horizon.
Sure.
When you're looking 10, 20 years in the future, what you're really setting out is aspirations. You're saying, this is where we would like to be. But you have to acknowledge that you don't know how you're going to get there. You have to be absolutely clear that your expectations, that your your assumptions will shift dramatically over that period. So while it's really valuable to lay out a mission and a vision for that time period, what you've also got to do is much more frequently look at the near future and say, how do we constantly adjust our direction and our behaviour to try and get towards that ultimate vision and mission? And maybe sometimes readjust the vision and mission. The best analogy I can think of is sat-nav. Sure. You're setting out on a journey, you sit down and you tap in your destination, and the sat-nav says, okay, we're going to go this way. This is the fastest route to where we want to get to. Yeah. But throughout the journey, it's constantly updating based on traffic situations and saying, actually, that's not the best route anymore. We have to go this way or that way. And you're right now, most of our planning activity says, here's where we want to get to. The fastest route is a straight line between two points, and whatever happens, we're going to keep trying to bludgeon our way through the traffic. Rather than saying, actually, we need to be able to adapt rapidly and react quickly to those changing conditions.
Sure, yeah, that makes sense. I guess every time you see a strategy, it tends to be very set in stone, and taking that more flexible approach is probably for the best, actually. I like the sat-nav analogy you gave.
Yeah, and one of the things I learned when I was doing the research for the book was actually just how bad we are, even at those processes we think we understand.
Sure.
So one of the stats that came out of some work I did with Profix, a Canadian software company, around this was that around 2/3 of companies say that their budget and their strategy don't even align.
Right.
So companies are laying out this strategy for what they're going to do, and they're never actually putting the money behind doing it, or not putting the money in the right places anyway. So even those things we think we do today to plan for the future, we're actually generally pretty bad at.
So the book is split into three different sections. So first one, how change is changing, athletic organisations and the human response. So I want to ask you about the rise of robots. You do mention this in your book as a topic, and it's incredibly current at the moment. So what are your views on the future of robots and employment in terms of how sort of the world of work is changing now?
I'm a long-term optimist but short-term pessimist, and right now I think we've got a revolution on our doorstep for which we haven't properly prepared. There's been very limited discussion of this at government level, and I think a lot of organisations haven't got their heads around it yet. And it's not going to happen as fast as people think. We're still working out how to get the most out of Microsoft Office, I think, 20, 30 years after it was launched. Most of us still don't use it to its maximum capability. And the same is going to be true of AI and robotics. But ultimately, it's very hard to see how we still have the same number of jobs 20, 30 years in the future when we've started to apply these technologies. And I'll give you a really practical example. Call centres. We can now already produce an AI, and I use that term loosely,
sure,
driven call centre operative that people prefer to deal with over and above a human being. This isn't your sort of dial 9 and bang your head against a brick wall call centre. This is actually an emotionally engaged, aware, digital call centre operative that serves you quicker than a human ever could. It can answer every call on the first ring. It can serve as many people as you want to simultaneously, so there's never any call waiting. And there's no sort of mucking around. It can give you the answer or it can't. And so we employ the best part of 1 million people, I think, in this country in call centres. And it's very hard to see how there's anything more than maybe 200,000 of those left in 20, 30 years' time.
Yeah.
There's lots of different categories of work like that where it's really hard to see how a human being can compete and how the human beings who are doing it today can shift naturally to the growth areas of work. I do have a concern that we lose a lot of the areas of mass employment. There will definitely be jobs growth in certain areas, and there will be new, interesting, really exciting jobs created by this. And actually, a lot of the jobs that continue to exist will be different. They'll be more fun and more creative because a lot of the drudgery is taken by machines.
Yeah.
But at the same time, at the very minimum, there's going to be a difficult transition period. And at the maximum, we may end up with a much lower level of structural employment based on how much machines can do.
Yeah, but I guess this isn't anything new, sort of moving from an agricultural to an industrial revolution. This thing has happened before. It's just, I guess, is it sort of our first experience of it, our first big change from sort of human-led employment to sort of more AI and sort of getting that admin out of the way with sort of technology?
Well, I think that's the critical shift. You know, the big shift now is, in the past, what we've done is we've used automation to overcome physical limitations. Yeah. And those physical limitations quite often weren't human. You know, it was horses or, you know, shifts from steam to combustion engine. You know, this is the first revolution in cognitive work. And that's the really big transformation for me, because, you know, in the past, we've never been able to replace humans' ability to do cognitive work. Now that we can, it's hard to see what categories of work there are beyond perhaps the creative and the caring that remain growth sectors for humans. As I say, I think there will be individual industries which grow and develop and become, you know, much more exciting and fun, actually, because machines can do the work.
Yeah.
But then, you know, there's also lots of categories of work where you can see that there'll be growth, but it'll be growth for machines rather than growth for humans.
Sure. Yeah, that's really fascinating. So you work with many global 500 corporations. What are the common problems that you face or are frequently asked that you find arise again and again, and how do you go about solving them?
Yeah, I get called in by for three different reasons, really. You know, one of them is really positive. It says, look, we think this change in the future, come and, you know, shake us up, inspire us, get us thinking.
Sure, yeah.
One of them is when there's a specific need, so they've identified, you know, an opportunity or a threat and they want help addressing it. But one of them is out of sheer fear, when companies or senior people within companies have said, do you know what, I think we're too static.
Okay.
I don't think we're seeing what's coming around the corner, and I'm concerned that we're not seeing it. And sometimes that call comes because it's already happened. They've missed something that was happening, and it's caused serious disruption. They want to avoid it happening in the future. And yet I think there's this really common trait, and it's one to look out for in your own organisation all the time, is I think you can spend, if you spend more than 6 months in any organisation, the blinkers come down and you start to lose perspective.
Yeah.
And I think the ability to maintain perspective after that sort of 6 month honeymoon period is very, very rare. I think there are very few people who can do it. And the way to spot it is, you know, when you bring new ideas to the table and talk about things that are happening in other industries, adjacent industries, similar industries, if you start to hear phrases like, oh, that could never happen here, or this industry's different, or, you know, our customers don't like that, or our customers don't think like that, you know that people are too locked into the processes and behaviours and sort of normality of their industry, and almost, you know, immunised against change, immunised against the possibility that of change and disruption. And that's when you really need to start to shake things up, to bring in new thinking, whether it's someone like me, or, you know, start to change the way your leadership works, start to do some formal foresight exercises to scan the horizon for what might cause disruption, or maybe just bring in some new blood. Yeah. You know, one thing I see a lot when I go into organisations is the ones in the most trouble are often the happiest. If you've got lots of people who've been there a long time, love their job, love their employer, came up through the graduate scheme and have stayed 15 years, 20 years, and they're now in a leadership position and really lack recent experience of any other industry, sector or company, there's often a dearth of disruptive ideas, and that can be really risky.
Sure. Yeah, and I often hear the phrase change resilience, which I think is quite common, as you said, when you get to that level and you get quite comfortable. So, yeah, I'm glad someone agrees.
Yeah, and, you know, and often actually what's really interesting is you find that there is a lot of people at the top of the organisation who've recognised this, or at least some people at the top of the organisation who've recognised this. And there's a lot of people at the bottom of the organisation who are really hungry for change.
Yeah.
And sometimes that sort of resilience to change comes in the middle. Sometimes it's the other way around, actually. You quite often find in those organisations where you've got long-serving leadership, it's the people at the level immediately below who are really hungry for change and trying to drive, you know, difference and trying to drive changes in behaviour.
For people that can see that there is sort of this halt in an acceptance for change and this change resilience in an organisation, how would they, especially if they don't have the authority to do so, how would they sort of go around creating more of a culture of change and for new ideas?
So one of the most effective methods I've found is to highlight risk for people, and not new risk, but risk that people are really aware of already. And I look at these things called pressure points.
Okay.
You know, if you get a bunch of people from the same company in a room and ask them to talk about what doesn't work, Ask them to talk about what frustrates them, what limits their productivity, yeah. what is constraining the success of their industry. You very rapidly start to fill sheets and sheets of paper with lists of things that they want to address. But they just sort of deal with in their day-to-day work. And if you then point out to them that every single one of the things on those lists is an opportunity for someone from outside to come in and disrupt their business, every single one of those things is a crack in their armour, you know, a chink into which a new competitor can slide and find an opportunity. Yeah. They start to realise that the innovation perhaps has slowed and stopped, perhaps they're not addressing some of the critical issues with their business. And it's very rare that I go into a business and don't find, you know, lots of those things that create opportunities for disruption. And once people identify those, they're often quite motivated to address them, and then they'll look outside for new ideas.
Sure. No, that makes sense. So what's been the impact of the release of High Frequency Change for you?
It's been really dramatic, actually. So the book came out to the back end of June. Once we got all the launch activity out of the way, which was great fun, and you know, it was hugely satisfying to see it out there. I pretty much jumped on a plane and disappeared for a month. And while I was away, I just kept getting these emails from my the sort of virtual team who support me, saying, oh, this person's been in touch and this person's been in touch. And since I've been back, you know, it's been fascinating to see the response and start to catch up with all these inquiries that came in. And it's touched businesses, it's touched people who are recognising the same changes and starting to address it in their own ways. And it's almost, in many ways, it's like a whole second stage of research that could go into the book that sort of came after it, because people who are thinking with like minds are coming to me and saying, will you come and talk to us? So, you know, great example. Yeah. I went to speak to BMW the other day, and you know, BMW are doing some brilliant leadership development work for their teams in the UK. And while we use different terminology, so many of the issues they're addressing are the ones I address in the book. And actually, so many of their sort of prescription for the response is very similar as well. They're tackling exactly the same issues under different words. So it's been great to have the book out there. It was almost a catalyst for conversations with other people who are seeing the same phenomena, and you know, both validating my thoughts, which is very rewarding, but also taking them on as well and starting to say, well, you know, here's how we're addressing it. So it's led to some fascinating conversations and engagements.
That sounds brilliant. I mean, I just thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a real pleasure speaking to you. I think we've all got a lot to now go and think about. And obviously, just to remind everyone, it's High Frequency Change if you're interested in Tom's book. So if you do want to find out more, go to our website, www.lidpublishing.com, or keep an eye on our social media at Lid Publishing on all platforms. So thank you, Tom, and thank you for listening, and I'll see you next time on Lid Radio Podcast.